From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a conversation with NPR's Shankar Vedantam, whose Hidden Brain podcast becomes a weekly radio show this weekend.
Later, a movie tells the unique story of an Indiana farm boy turned Chicago day trader turned around-the-world sailor.
Initially, I thought, okay, this is a story about someone who sails around the world. And then as I was interviewing Alex, I started to realize, like, okay, maybe it's a story about someone who sails around the world and then how they feel after they've sailed around the world.
And we'll hear about In Tandem Theater's madcap but not disrespectful mashup of some of the greatest works of literature.
What's fun about this play is that the subject matter is dealt with such a fondness and respect for the books. There's no mean-spirited making fun of these books.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. It was about a year ago that we first spoke with NPR Shankar Vedantam. He's a social science correspondent for the network, and he's also the host of Hidden Brain. That started out as an occasional segment on Morning Edition. It grew to become a podcast, and beginning this weekend, it becomes a weekly hour-long program on NPR.
The Hidden Brain has taken on a wide range of subjects, from the science of ignorance to how people use free speech arguments to the role of regret in our lives. The goal is to take disparate scientific research and translate it into an understanding of how it affects all of our lives. With a new program beginning this weekend, we caught up with Shankar Vedantam from the studios of NPR in Washington. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mitch. Glad to be here.
What are the challenges in taking this subject matter and scaling it first up from, you know, 4 or 5 minute segments on Morning Edition to podcast length and now to an hour? How is telling these stories changing?
I think it's changing quite a bit. In some ways, there's a temptation when something works in one medium to just simply take it in that same form and use it in another medium. But of course, that doesn't work because each medium has its own requirements. And you know, some things work well on one medium but don't work on another. So the podcast actually has evolved quite a bit from the Morning Edition segments. And I think the radio show is going to be a further evolution. We're certainly going to be able to tell stories in much greater depth. We'll also be exploring stories much more at the level of narratives and following the individual lives of people to illustrate the science that we're talking about. We'll also be able to talk about the science in much greater complexity and nuance and be able to bring out many, many different sides of an issue. So my sense is that the radio show in some ways is an evolution of the podcast, and the podcast, of course, was an evolution of the Morning Edition series.
You mentioned the idea of narrative, and scientific journal articles aren't generally written with any kind of narrative arc in mind, or the narrative arc that does exist is not meant for the general reader.
Yep.
When does the translation process begin for you as you start to read a journal article? At what point do you start to apply it to real life, if you will?
I start doing that from the very second I'm reading something in the scientific journals. You know, as a journalist, one of the things that you really want to do is to try and find ways to connect things that are in the news with the things that people care about in their daily lives, with the things that are really rigorous and well done in terms of research from the ivory tower. And so as I'm looking at daily events, I'm thinking about research studies that would fit those daily events. As I'm reading research studies, I'm thinking about topical issues that the research study would be able to speak with. So this idea of trying to meld together things that are topical with things that people care about, with things that are, you know, well-conceived pieces of research, that's happening all the time and simultaneously.
Do you see yourself in a strange way as doing a service to the cause of social science research in doing this show and this podcast?
Absolutely. I think in some ways the show is trying to bridge the world between, you know, the ivory tower and the public square. And so to the extent that, you know, journalists are providing this bridge, I think we are performing a service of sorts. You know, one of the things that I've long thought about is, you know, we often talk about income and wealth inequalities in our world. And of course, those are very important to talk about. But there's an even bigger disparity, which is the disparity of knowledge. There are people in the world who know a great deal about many things, and these pieces of knowledge have huge applications in our daily lives, but very often we don't know that someone sitting in some university somewhere has come up in some ways with an insight that can help us lead our lives better. And I feel like it's my job, and it's certainly our job at Hidden Brain, to try and build that bridge, to try and bring ideas out of the ivory tower into the public square where they can actually be used and wrestled with and taken advantage of.
Are there compelling reasons? Because a lot of researchers, the rub on scientific research, especially social science research, has always been that there is this kind of code or language that you have to cut through to be able to understand what's going on. And that's one of the things that you and the Hidden Brain team do so well. But I'm curious whether, as someone who knows this field, is there something at stake for the researchers to keep writing in the kind of academic ease that they do? I mean, are there compelling reasons for them to keep doing that?
You know, I've actually wrestled with this question for a long time, Mitch, because I've often wondered about it. Why would people who have spent so much time, you know, developing ideas, honing ideas, testing ideas, writing them up, getting them peer-reviewed, getting them published, why isn't there a huge appetite within the academy to take those ideas out and share them with the public? Now, to be fair, there are lots of researchers who actually want to do that. Lots of people are trying to do that. And certainly, I think, among younger researchers, there's a real appetite for doing that. But I do think that there's a gap. I think in many ways the academy, for whatever reason, prizes, you know, people communicating very well within the academy, but doesn't really prize or incentivize people for communicating very well outside the academy. And I think that's a real tragedy, because what happens then is that the public sphere, the conversations that we're having about all manner of things are often being populated by people who are not the smartest people, who haven't done the most rigorous work, who haven't been the most thoughtful about an issue. And I think that provides an opportunity for a show like Hidden Brain to say, can we again take those ideas from the ivory tower, bring them out to the public square, which is where they can be most useful.
Do you think there's a certain tribalism at work here?
I don't think the issue is tribalism. I think it has more to do with sort of the norms within the academy. You know, I was talking some time ago with Dan Gilbert. He's a psychologist at Harvard University, and he also happens to be a very, very fine writer. And there were times when I would be reading a psychology journal, and I would be four pages into a paper, and I would sort of stop and say, this paper is really well written. I mean, it has references from, you know, Greek and Roman mythology, and it has beautiful references to poetry, and the sentences are crafted with great care. And I would turn and look at who the authors were, and Dan Gilbert would be one of the authors. And I remember talking to him once and asking him the question that you're asking me, which is, why aren't more researchers interested in becoming good communicators? And he actually said that there's almost a bias within the academy against people who are very good communicators, because if you write a paper and it has all of these literary and artistic flourishes, your peers in some ways are a little suspicious of you. They're going to say, are you doing all of this hand-waving because your science actually isn't very good? And in some ways, Dan told me that he's actually had to, in some ways, tone down his writing in his papers in order for it to be taken seriously among his academic peers. And so these are, you know, the different institutions and different cultures have different norms. I think one of the norms in the academy is that serious people, you know, communicate in a way that is very precise and very specific, even if that uses a lot of jargon and makes the ideas impenetrable to the general public.
And at the same time, one of the great things that I think you're doing is making the point that these two worlds are not necessarily mutually exclusive.
No, they're not mutually exclusive. And in fact, if you think of where the need is, there's a huge need for those ideas to come out, into the public square. You know, there's a thought experiment that I sometimes play with myself. You know, if you imagine that we don't develop any new knowledge for the rest of humankind, right? Everything we know today is the only thing we're ever going to know. We're not going to do any more research. We're not going to build any more. We're not going to write new textbooks. It's just that what we have today is all the knowledge we're ever going to have. But we focus all of our efforts not on generating new knowledge, but in making sure that the person who is the least informed person on the planet is as well informed as the best informed person on the planet today. So imagine a world where the least informed person on the planet today knows as much as the best informed person on the planet today. What kind of a world would we live in? And I think the utility of that thought experiment really speaks to this idea that getting the knowledge out to where it's actually needed, getting ideas and insight out to where they're actually needed, is every bit as vital as making sure that you're living in a society that is an equal society, that is an egalitarian society, that when you have these huge disparities of knowledge, those disparities then become the underpinning of all kinds of other disparities that we see in society.
Do you have a favorite journal that you go back to time and again?
You know, I'm not sure I do, and I'll tell you why. I actually am not really even paying very much attention to the specific names of the journals that I'm reading, because very often what I'm finding is that it's not so much an individual story or an individual study or an individual paper produces the idea for a story for the podcast or for the radio show. It typically takes, you know, 5 or 6 different pieces of research. And, you know, we've divided up the world of research into these categories. You know, we sort of say there's the world of psychology, and then there's the world of sociology, and then there's economics over here, and there's medicine over there, and there's health over here. But the truth is, all these disciplines are all basically looking at similar things, right? Where they're just sort of different perspectives on the same phenomena. And in some ways, what you have to do, I think, if you're going to be building a show like Hidden Brain, is to be able to make the connection between, you know, the journal study that's in economics with something that's happening in psychology, with something that's happening in the news. And I think it's playing that game. I don't know what the right metaphor or analogy would be for that kind of game. It's sort of jumping between these fields, which is where the action lies. It's not so much, is there a favorite journal that you can go to that has the best, you know, ideas for stories, but how do you draw connections between these things that are happening in different journals, that are happening in real life, that are happening in the news, that people care about in their daily lives? When you can pull all of that together, that's when you have a great story.
It's like the Venn diagram game.
I guess that's right. Maybe the Venn diagram is the idea. You have these intersecting circles, and you want that point where all the circles are intersecting with one another.
Shankar Vedantam, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Looking forward to hearing the show.
Thanks so much, Mitch.
Shankar Vedantam is host of NPR's Hidden Brain. The Morning Edition segment, Turn Podcast, is becoming a weekly show that airs on WUWM at 11 a.m. on Sundays, beginning this weekend. And Lake Effect is on every day, including the weekends. And we are here right now on the third day of our fall membership drive, asking for your support. Mitch, what is our goal this hour?
Our goal is $900. We can do it with your help when you call 414-227-3210 or you visit us at wuwm.com/give. And today only, if you have waited until the third day of our fall membership drive, don't worry, because today only, when you donate $5 or more today, you'll receive a certificate good for a free waffle cone or a serving of house-made churros at the Ruckus in Shorewood. That's on Oakland Avenue. The waffle cone comes with, it does come with ice cream, fortunately.
Yum.
soft serve ice cream and your choice of crumble, including, yes, cinnamon sugar, churro crumble, cowboy crumble, or choco chip crumble.
Mm. I wonder what Shankar Vedantam would say about the science of
deciding which crumble you want. It's an interesting question.
Maybe we should ask him.
Next time he's on, we will ask him. But in the meantime, you take advantage of just this little break we have in our programming to call 414-227-3210 or visit us at wuwm.com/give and help us reach our goal of $900 during this hour of Lake Effect.
Coming up next, a new documentary tells the compelling story of a Midwestern farm boy turned around-the-world sailor. We'll hear about chasing bubbles when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. If you knew the late Alex Rust when he was a young man, you might not have expected that he'd be the person about whom a documentary would be made. Rust was a farm boy from Indiana who became a day trader working at the Chicago Board of Trade. But by the time he was 25, he realized he had other fish to fry.
Rust quit his job, moved to Florida, and bought a small sailboat and set out on an adventure, learning to sail as he headed for the far corners of the world. His unlikely story is now the subject of a documentary which is screening at the Milwaukee Film Festival called Chasing Bubbles. We're joined now in the studio by film editor Chris Thompson and via Skype by director Topher Cochran. Cochran and Alex Rust's best friend and fellow traveler Ross Gerber. Cochran explains why Rust was such a compelling subject for a film.
We started making it while he was still alive, and I was interested in A, telling the story that he had, and then B, sort of exploring his want to tell the story and his want to travel and his sort of need to explore and need to try new things. I thought that was sort of an interesting drive or question about a person as a premise, to just as a place to begin.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us have that, you know, we want to explore new things. Most of us don't have quite that passion about it. We're not willing to go off for 3 years without really knowing what we're doing. Most of us aren't brave enough. And I think there was a certain kind of emotional bravery as well as a physical bravery that he had that seemed incredibly appealing.
Yeah, absolutely, Bonnie. This is Ross. And Alex 100% would dive into things headfirst, and it was no different with this trip. He, you know, when he set out on this trip, he was always wanting to record everything that was happening. And so I was actually on the trip with him for a portion of the time. And when we came back, he had all of this footage and he just wanted to share it with people, and he didn't know how. And, you know, we were friends with Topher, so Topher was the movie maker. So it just made sense to, you know, start meeting up and seeing what we could make.
3 years worth of filming.
Yeah, I think we had about 100 hours. Chris, how many? Where did we start?
I think it was more like 250 hours, if I had to count. But he was filming with flip phones. He was filming with mini DV cameras. He was taking photos. He was recording audio. He was doing interviews with his friends that were on the boat, with strangers, with people on islands or at ports that he met. And I think, in a strange way, as we've been making the film, from an editing perspective, we realize that he's actually one of the best filmmakers, untrained filmmakers, that any of us have ever come in contact with. So a lot of the fun of this project was sort of celebrating this unknown, unskilled filmmaker, in a sense that he wasn't trained, but he was a natural at it.
Kind of like being a sailor.
Exactly.
For one of the things we found when we were making it, it was a movie about someone who is trying to make a movie about themselves.
But also trying to figure out who he was.
Totally.
And so, yeah. Ross, how much of the trip were you on? It was a 3-year journey. How much of that were you actually participating in?
So I was involved for probably 6 months. I was on his initial first sail. So, and you had mentioned that he was learning to sail, and that's completely true. When he jumped on the boat, he had no idea what he was doing, and through the trip, he ended up losing his engine. So he actually had to learn how to become a sailor. And by the end of the trip, he was a phenomenal sailor. But yeah, I was on the trip for a total of 6 months and probably 5,000 miles. So just a portion of the trip, but I did cross the Pacific Ocean. So that was the longest crossing and passage that he did. But I was not along the entire time.
Just a small portion. Only the Pacific Ocean.
Only the Pacific, yeah. Obviously, a trip like that changes everyone, and that's part of the film. He didn't quite know what to do with himself once it was done. For you, what was it like to get off the ship and resume your life?
It was, I was only on the boat, again, for the 6 months, but it was actually tricky after the after the crossing we did. I mean, for about 4 months, it was just, you know, me and Alex in Diego. For the most part, we would see other folks, you know, when we stopped on islands. But it was surprisingly difficult to get used to just to being in, like, meetings in my corporate life. I had spent so many months just really talking to two other people that once I got back, I've always been a talkative person, but it was actually difficult just to converse and to get up in front of people and kind of get my brain back into this, a completely different mode. So surprisingly more difficult than I thought it would be. I thought it would just be where I left off, and it wasn't at all.
How long did it take you to cross the Pacific?
So it was only from the Galapagos to the first island in French Polynesia. It was 20 days, and surprisingly flies by quickly. We were, we would sleep in like 3-hour increments because we were on watch, and time 100% flies when you're just completely fatigued, because we're sitting in the sun all day long, not sleeping. And I mean, pretty much the only thing we're doing was getting up, you know, looking at the water, and then eating and sleeping. So it surprisingly flew, those 20 days.
Yeah, I have to say, there is something about, as I was watching the film, and I think Alex's footage captured that so well, of just the what it's like to be on that massive water.
It's fun to think that, like, when you're out there, the next closest human, that thing I always say is that the next closest human are the astronauts on the space station. There's nobody for 1,000 miles in any direction.
Yeah, it was very wild being out there, and especially I mean, we had a radio on the boat, but we hadn't set it up quite right, so unfortunately we could only hear what people were saying and we couldn't really talk to anyone. So we would just get, like, it was almost like being on a space station, like this Russian space station, where you'd hear, like, you know, the Sputnik, just, you know, scratchy voices, and we couldn't really communicate with anyone, and we would try to talk and no one would ever respond. So we were very much on our own out there, and that was a little terrifying. But on a sailboat, you're also going so slow, so it's in a funny way, you weren't, like, scared you were gonna tip because you're going so slowly, but it was terrifying in the fact that if something, you know, if you slipped chopping a vegetable and cut yourself, you were relying on each other for first aid.
Topher, when you started going through the 250 hours of footage, how did you decide what story to tell? I imagine there were lots of different ways you could have approached this movie.
I would watch the footage and initially and interview Alex and then think about what I'd seen, or I would take notes as I was watching footage sort of early on. And I would just, like, kind of have these questions, and I kept a list of sort of questions about Alex, questions about the story, questions about what might make a person make those choices or want to live that way. And I kind of just kept this list of questions. And then I guess the ones that I thought felt significant or felt important to me, those sort of became an outline and sort of like a structure. And then we would shoot interviews sort of trying to answer those questions. And then at some point, I got as far as I could with the interviews and the watching the footage that I had, and that's when Chris came in, and he had my outline, sort of the structure of what I thought the movie would be, and then he kind of came at it from his own angle and found whole new stories and sort of subplots, and we sort of filled in my sort of broader outline from that. But initially I thought, okay, this is a story about someone who sails around the world. And then as I was interviewing Alex, I started to realize, like, okay, well, maybe it's a story about someone who sails around the world and then how they feel after they've sailed around the world. Like, after you are in your 20s and you wake up every day on a sailboat that's yours and you can decide, okay, are we going to point towards Antarctica? Or are we going to point towards a tropical island? And, okay, are we going to go hang out with these beautiful girls? Or are we going to go hang out with these local people and drink a type of rum that no one's tasted in 50 years. Like, and after you wake up every day with those sorts of choices before you, what do you do next? How do you feel after that? What does that sort of travel or that sort of freedom do to a person? It was, as I was talking to him, questions like that just sort of became present. They were sort of right there. And I was as interested in answering those sorts of things as I was, what does it take to sail around the world? And that's sort of how we got the story. And then all the fun little, I mean, Alex was such a charismatic guy that all the fun adventures and stories and images that he shot and that things that really happened to him, they were just there. And Chris was able to sort of fill in the structure with all these great little moments.
Just to add to that, what I always thought about when, you know, talking to Alex about this huge goal he accomplished is, in football, sometimes they'll interview, like, a quarterback after he wins a Super Bowl and ask him what he's going to do next, and it's just kind of like this blank stare on his face. You know, he wants to win another Super Bowl. That's been, since he was five, it's been a single-minded goal. And I thought that's kind of a good comparison for Alex, is it's just like he accomplished this huge goal. And, you know, like, going to the moon, you know, would be like the next step in his mind. So I think it was interesting to explore, you know, what you do after that.
It didn't make it in the movie, but in some of the interviews we were doing and the research we were doing while we were making the film, we'd found a couple people who had been sailing across oceans with Alex. And, you know, you have, like Ross mentioned earlier, you just have hours and hours to talk. You know, there's no internet. Alex said he had a list of things to Google. like for when they would get to land again. But one of the things that came up, someone had asked Alex, what do you think you'd want to do next as they were sailing across the Indian Ocean? And Alex said, go to Mars. And everyone thought he was joking, but as they, you know, probed further and asked him further about going to Mars, he was able to extrapolate and plan. And I mean, he actually thought that maybe a good goal for him would be to go to space after having sailed around the world, which it's interesting. I mean, someone who's just a kid from middle America who decides I'm going to sail around the world. Why shouldn't he be able to decide to go to space next? I mean, maybe that's the time we live, or maybe that's possible. Maybe anything's possible.
Well, also, he had the kind of personality, it seems, that allowed for that. I mean, he was never going to be happy. At least the man I got to know through the film, he was never going to be happy sitting at a desk. He was never going to be happy having a normal 9-to-5 existence.
Yeah, and I guess I was curious, what's life like for that person? Or can they imagine an endgame? What does happiness look like for somebody who was sailing around the world? They had this very clearly defined goal. I'm going to get on a small fiberglass sailboat that I buy and own myself, and I'm going to sail it around the world, you know, my own way. Once you do that, if you're a searcher, how do you shape your life after that?
One of the most interesting things about putting this film together in hindsight was, like, if you think about your own life, we have periods in time where we advance, whether it's a teacher or a brother or sister, or someone, a mentor, a neighbor. You can remember back to certain months or summers or years of your life where you grew a ton because someone forced you and pushed you to imagine new things, to try new things, and they were just super inspiring to you. And in a way, you grew more in a month or a week or a year than maybe you did the 5 years before that, the 5 years after that. And we can all remember back to times or periods or mentors that help us grow like that. And the interesting thing about listening to all these interviews of all the people that were around Alex is that he was the person that helped them all in that way. And that was so cool, was that even though it seemed like at times Alex was lost, he was changing all these people around him. He was changing their lives by asking them to imagine, where could you go? What are you afraid of? What's holding you back? Is it you? Is it really money? It's probably not money. Is it really your own intellect? It's probably not. It's yourself. It's just, what is holding you back? Imagine how far you could go if you just really went for it. And everyone around him kind of had that same story, that was how much he influenced them. And I think that was like the funnest reason to make this film, was we all need to be reminded of that. And I think he reminded everyone around him of that every single day.
It seems like he might have needed a bit of that himself, though, towards the end of the film, that he could have used somebody to come in and say, hey, let's do this, rather than having to come up with it himself necessarily.
Yeah, no, it was, I think there were a lot of us that were trying to help him figure out what was next for him and what that inspiration would be. And, you know, myself and a few other people did, you know, recommend, you know, going to India and trying to be inspired through helping other people. Even though he helped a ton of people along the way, it would be, you know, just, you know, giving himself to an orphanage where he could keep his hands busy and getting that sort of a reward, as opposed to the reward he was getting through traveling.
What do you think he would be doing now had he lived?
He was also an engineer, and he liked the idea of solving problems, which was a cool thing about him. He was really DIY, and he liked to sort of fix things himself and like figure out ways to solve problems. And he was always interested in these big picture problems, like what are some of the problems with the Earth, and maybe there's some simple, elegant solutions out there we can find. He had said something about how when he was at sea, he'd noticed all the plastic that's floating in this sort of like floating garbage problem that we have in our oceans right now. And I heard him spitball one time about like maybe there's a way we can rethink how we make plastic cups or how we make plastic whatever, so that we could make the world a better place by making things differently or building things differently. I wonder if he would have tried to find a problem and fix it.
Or a series of problems, because it sounds like he was also the kind of guy who did fix them and then move on to the next one.
Certainly, yeah.
I could see him doing some sort of like sustenance farming or something like that with a whole bunch of kids, because I know he always wanted to have more kids than his dad, and I could see him just having a huge family.
He has 13 brothers and sisters.
I was going to say he's one of 14. So yeah, that's quite ambitious. Yeah, to think that.
His goal was to outdo his dad from a child perspective. So if he would have gotten anywhere close, it would have been a huge family.
The film, since we haven't said it enough, it's Chasing Bubbles is the name of it. And I want to thank you guys so much for doing it and making the film. And what a great tribute to a wonderful person that I feel.
Thank you, Bonnie.
I feel like I know him after this. And I think that's a pretty terrific thing.
Oh, cool. Yep. Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Bonnie.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Chasing Bubbles screens at the Milwaukee Film Festival this afternoon at 4 and Sunday evening as well. We spoke with filmmakers Ross Gerber and Topher Cochran via Skype and Milwaukee-based editor Chris Thompson here in the studio. You can read more at WUWM.com. The Milwaukee Film Festival goes on through the 12th of October. It's a huge part of our cultural landscape this time of year, and Lake Effect is proud to be able to highlight some of the films, not all of them, because there are a whole lot of films, but some of the films, the noteworthy ones that are showing at the film festival this year. Chasing Bubbles is a good example of that, but we have other films that we'll be highlighting between now and the end of the film festival, and even talking with some filmmakers for interviews that will air after the festival's over. It's part of our robust art coverage that really, you know, is a signature of Lake Effect.
It is, and it's one of the things that you support with your contribution. When you call 414-227-3210 or you go to WUWM.com/give, you are making a contribution right now to support exactly this kind of programming. And you've told us that the arts programming is one of the things that you really appreciate, that there is really nowhere else that you can find this kind of detail.
We talk about the beat reporting that we have at Milwaukee Public Radio, things like environment and education and race and ethnicity. But arts reporting was kind of the original beat reporting, the original dedicated position when we brought Bonnie on board, these 11 years ago, get a good handle and make Lake Effect the destination for visiting artists and people who ply their trade here each and every day.
And today only, if arts coverage is not enough to get you to make a contribution.
How about ice cream?
Ice cream will do it. Ice cream or churros. I have to say churros is probably calling me a little more than ice cream. But for $5 or more of a donation today, you will receive a certificate good for a free waffle cone with ice cream or a serving of house-made churros at the Ruckus in Shorewood. And that sounds like a good deal to me.
You know, maybe you can't decide between the two. If I remember correctly, when you get that ice cream in the waffle cone, one of the toppings can be crushed churros.
There you go. It's a win-win.
The best of both worlds. And you're supporting public radio. It's the best of all three worlds.
It is fantastic. So you know what to do. 414-227-3210 or WUWM.com/give. And thanks.
One more break, and then we'll learn how In Tandem Theater is drawing on some of the greatest works of literature to form the backbone of a very funny production on stage this month. It's All the Great Books, abridged, when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
It's Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Do you remember cramming for a test, trying to regurgitate everything you learned over a semester so that you could pass the final exam and get out of high school intact? Sure you do. That is the situation a 12th grade English class finds itself in a play on stage at In Tandem Theater this month. But there is a twist.
In this case, three teachers, a student teacher, the gym teacher, and a drama teacher, all combine forces to portray some of the greatest works of literature in rapid fire and very funny form. The play is called All the Great Books Abridged, and I caught up with director Chris Fleer and actors Ryan Schabach, Chris Good, and Doug Jarecki on a break from rehearsal. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes to talk with me.
Thank you,
Bonnie. Good to be here.
So tell me about this play.
This is part of the Reduced Shakespeare Company's franchise of abridged versions of many different subjects. They've done the complete works of Shakespeare abridged, the Bible abridged, American history abridged, all of moviedom abridged. This one is my personal favorite because it kind of follows a narrative arc, and it's just got some remarkably comically staged bits to help you along with delving into the complex world of the great world's literature.
Who are all of you? Do you play many characters?
We do have set characters that we play. For example, I play Coach, who is the gym teacher and coach. But throughout the course of the play, we jump into different characters as we bring these different books to life. So we are, all of us are a little bit of everything in every book, I think.
Chris, do you have a main?
Yes, I'm playing the student teacher, and like Doug and Ryan, we're constantly putting on hats and dresses and vests and different clothing items when our characters are slipping into other characters from the world of literature. And so it's very manic and a lot of fun.
Okay, so we have the coach, the student teacher, and Ryan, you are?
And I'm the professor, the very egotistical, pompous, smarty pants, knows it all. Probably
English
hasn't
professor.
English. Well, yeah, professor of theater.
Oh.
Yes. Probably hasn't read any of these books, but fancies himself illiterate.
All right, so what's the setup? Why are we in this world of great literature?
So the audience is a remedial English class, and they've failed their midterm, and they need this class to graduate. Graduation is in 1 hour and 45 minutes. So these three fine gentlemen here have an abbreviated amount of time to take them through 89 of the world's greatest works of literature so they can graduate.
And mayhem ensues.
And yes, hilarity ensues.
Yes.
Yeah.
For the three actors, are there books that you hadn't read that now you want to read because of this? Or are you thinking, I never want to touch any of this stuff?
There were a shocking number of books that I had not read. And while my desire to read them has grown, my ability to do so probably has not. No, but I love, you know, we some of these books are classics that we read in school, and I have not read a lot of them. But what's fun about this play is that it's dealt with, the subject matter is dealt with such a fondness and respect for the books. There's no mean-spirited making fun of these books. It is written with a real genuine fondness for the works, and I think that just brings out even more of the humor in it as well. So it does make me want to go and read some of these. Maybe I will, Bonnie.
Which one?
The one with the most pictures.
Okay. Yeah.
I do think we make War and Peace sound really entertaining. I've never read War and Peace, but Coach says at one point that it has it all, and we're doing it all the things that War and Peace...
All the things of War and Peace.
Yeah, that, you know, supposedly has packed within it. So it does seem entertaining. Maybe I'll try to read War and Peace.
Put aside the summer.
Yes. For my light summer reading, I shall read War and Peace.
War and Peace. And how about you, Ryan?
I'm positive that I read War and Peace when I was supposed to be in undergrad, which I think I went to. But when I went back home the last time, I took a look at all of my paperback books, and I saw the bookmark was on page 5, so I have a feeling that I never made it through War and Peace. But it all sounds so familiar now that I have my lines memorized. And that's a joke. I don't have my lines memorized.
Yeah, we know.
Talk about the narrative arc. You said there's a narrative arc to this. I mean, do people have a quiz at the end? Or
The audience will not be quizzed. There is a question asked of the audience during intermission is, what do you feel are the two best works of literature and why? So the audience will be encouraged to fill out a little form, and we will read some of the responses during the second act of the show. But this show, because it's set up that there's a reward at the end, the graduation, that this must happen, and that there's a very limited amount of time in which it's going to happen, just increases the whole urgency, not only for the people on stage, but hopefully the audience will kind of get into the spirit of the thing to see if these guys can really, really pull it off. You know.
So are you actually interacting with the audience, or is there just too much happening in terms of being an actor that you can't do that?
The conceit that, like, we're all here and, like, you know, the audience is participating in the evening as much as the performers are, I think is the most fun part about it, because it's very engaging that way. And yeah, there are moments where it's less like you're watching, just simply watching a story unfold on stage, and more like you're part of it, whether or not you're directly engaged or not, because, you know, you're here in the Caffa Gymnatorium with us, and you have an objective just as much as we do to graduate.
Does audience response change anything that you do?
I think it definitely does. Yeah. The authors that have worked on this have worked on multiple other shows, just like what Chris was saying, and they've given us little hints as to what they've received in the thousands of productions that they've done previous to this. There's a podcast called The Reduced Shakespeare Company, and Austin Titchener, one of the writers of this, has that podcast, and he talks about how every single night is different and unique based off of what that audience gives back, because it's such a group culture. So if this whole new audience comes in with a different feeling one night versus the next, they kind of feed off of each other and we get a different response. And part of the joy of this piece is that you have to kind of be on your toes to feed off of what they're giving you.
Yeah, even more than normal. I mean, because theater requires that anyway. You even if you're doing Chekhov, if you're doing Shakespeare for real, you need to feed what's happening. But this sounds like it's even more instant.
90% of this show is direct address to the audience because these guys are basically teaching a class. You know, there are some exchanges between the characters, and that's also kind of an interesting difference between this particular piece and some of the other pieces that RSC has written, is that the characters are a little bit more fleshed out, and the way the characters relate to each other, the way they bump up against each other in terms of their different disciplines and their different assumptions about each other, kind of, is a little bit more explored, perhaps, in some of the other pieces. But that's why it's kind of interesting. It's because it's great fun for the audience to participate in either reviewing a book that they might have read in the past, or learning about a work that they had always meant to read but haven't, and perhaps that might spur them on to read the original work, but also to see the way that these three very different personality types and individuals have to come together and kind of set their differences aside in order to create this experience to get these people graduated, and how they kind of rise above themselves to do it.
So does Coach have a favorite book?
Oh, yeah, very much so. It is War and Peace, okay, because it has everything.
1.9 million pages
That's
of it.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, I think part of the fun of this, too, and it's really a nicely crafted piece, is that these three were not the first choices to teach this course. For a variety of reasons, they are the ones who, at the last minute, have stepped in to teach this course. So it's not as though they came in with a really well-prepared curriculum. This is a fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants, doing the best you can to remember that book that you maybe read in high school. And so there's a real sort of teetering on the edge energy that is from start to finish. And when it's a really well-written piece too, in that there are moments for the audience energy to become more of a part of a show than before. And it is that energy really fuels that whole, are they going to make it in time? Are they going to graduate? And it's really, it has sort of a anything might happen next sort of a feel, which is fantastic.
And it could.
It could.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yes. None of us are really memorized. So,
yes.
Yeah,
yes.
It could happen.
Yes. So does the student teacher have a favorite book?
His favorite book is The Lord of the Rings.
Why am I not surprised?
Yeah, well, even though he thinks that it was the book that was based on the series of movies, so nonetheless, he still loves it very much.
Okay. And how about the theater professor?
Well, the theater professor is very much intimidated by War and Peace. I would say that would be the least favorite book, does not want to do that. But the professor is very much enamored of a bunch of poems and has a whole section where it kind of combines a lot of poetry into a short little medley.
Is there a quick scene that you guys could do for me to give us a taste?
We could do perhaps a little bit. They take on the monumental task of distilling Miguel de Cervantes' Don Quixote into about a 3-minute section. And they also do it in the original Spanish, as translated by Christopher, the student teacher.
Okay.
I just put Ryan on the spot here because he's been struck with this man.
It's radio. You can use your script.
I need to find my script here.
Yes.
Let's get some background noise.
Just a taste of,
yes,
of that.
Oh, right. Lord have mercy.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Miguel de Cervantes' classic Don Quixote, performed in the original Spanish with English subtitles.
Soy Don Quixote de la Mancha. I am Don Quixote of La Mancha.
El desechador de injusticia.
The undoer of injustice.
El protector de doncellas.
The protector of damsels.
Y el terror de gigantes.
And the terror of giants.
Montaré mi magnifico caballo, Rocinante.
I will ride on my magnificent horse, Rocinante.
Ah, Rocinante.
Rocinante.
Hola, señor Quijado. Me llamo Sancho Panza. ¿Cómo está?
Hello, Mr. Quijado. My name is Sancho Panza. How
no,
are you?
Soy señor Quijado. Soy Don Quijote de La Mancha.
I am not Mr. Quijado. I am Don Quijote of La Mancha.
Yo requiero un escudero fiel para mi pesquisa.
I require a faithful squire for my quest.
¿Me acompañas?
Will you join me?
No sé.
I'm not sure.
Quiero hacer bien.
I want to do right.
A los hechos malos.
To right wrongs.
Y impresionar Dulcinea.
And to win the love of Dulcinea.
La chica con los melones más grandes en España.
The girl with the biggest hands in Spain.
Sí, te acompañarás en tu sueño imposible.
Yes, I will join you in your impossible dream.
Pero tengo miedo que yo no pueda marchar al paso de un asno de este tamaño.
But I'm afraid that I will not be able to keep pace with an ass of this size.
¿Y cómo fue que Cristóbal pudo hacer todo en inglés?
And how come Christopher gets to do the whole scene in English?
Porque Cristóbal es estúpido.
Because Christopher is stupendous. Hola. Hello.
Andale!
Let's ride.
Alto!
Stop.
Mira, amigo Sancho. Gigantes.
Look, friend Sancho, giants.
Usted es loco. Todo lo que veo son molinos de vientos.
You are delusional, my friend. All I see are windmills.
No estoy loco.
Sanity is overrated.
Perdóname.
I'm sorry.
Mi mal.
My bad.
Gracias.
Thank you.
They know what gracias means.
¿Saben qué quiere decir gracias?
Tengo que atacar.
I must attack.
Ha ha!
There were coconuts.
There were coconuts, yes. They're super fun.
You can't go wrong.
No.
If there are coconuts.
It's brilliant.
Yeah. Guys, thank you so much.
Thank you so much
for that.
Thanks a lot, Bonnie.
And best of luck.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Chris Fleer directs, and Ryan Schabach, Chris Good, and Doug Jarecki star in Tandem Theater's production of All the Great Books Abridged, which opens tonight and runs through the 29th at the 10th Street Theater.
And finally today, we'll have a recording from a Lake Effect studio session. Welsh singer-songwriter Martin Joseph is in Wisconsin touring with Milwaukee's Willie Porter. They're playing tonight at the Cedarburg Cultural Center. We'll have the full interview coming up in the coming weeks. But for now, here is Joseph's original tune, Let Yourself.
I need you brave. I want you brave. I need you strong to sing along. You are beautiful. I am not wrong. And even today this timeline is fine. There's enough for us to find that path ahead and let the whole thing roll on. Are you drifting away? Are you falling apart? Just let yourself be quietly drawn by the stronger call of what you really love and let your soul, the one that you brought with you safe to this moment in time, let it whisper to the fear and let it wrestle with the noise of this night for you. If we could just step outside and look at ourselves for a moment, we might see there's a different way that we can be. Don't expect to find all the answers of this world, 'cause if you could somehow and then you did tell me, who would you be? But if you are drifting away, and if you're falling apart, just let yourself be quietly drawn by the stronger call of what you really love and Let your soul, the one that you brought with you safe to this moment in time, let it whisper to the fear and let it wrestle with the noise of the night for you. And in the midst of these moments, it's like we've never left. But there's a lifetime of returning, and we are not home yet. This isn't home yet. I need you brave, want you brave, I need you strong. Sing along, you are beautiful, and for once I am not wrong. And you can bring it on, world, you throw everything, cause in the end love wins big, and there are some of us with no intention of lying. But if you're drifting away, if you are falling apart, that's all right. You just let yourself.
Welsh singer-songwriter Martin Joseph playing his song Let Yourself. He'll perform tonight at the Cedarburg Cultural Center with Wisconsin's own Willie Porter. Our in-studio session was engineered by Jason Reavy. And Jason Reavy is a good person to bring up because he is one of the many behind-the-scenes people that when you support Milwaukee Public Radio, you are making their jobs possible. Jason Reavy is our brand new, I guess he's not brand new anymore, but a fairly recent addition. He's our studio engineer, and he makes people like Martin Joseph sound terrific, if they didn't sound terrific already. But there are all sorts of people that you rarely, if ever, hear on the radio here, but they all play incredibly important roles in making this a healthy, viable public radio station. Won't you take just a few minutes now? Call 414-227-3210 or visit us at wuwm.com/give. You can check out all the interviews you've heard in recent days on Lake Effect, but also make your contribution right there on our website.
And today only, when you donate $5 or more, you will receive a certificate good for a free waffle cone with ice cream and toppings or a serving of house-made churros at the Ruckus in Shorewood. So that's a pretty sweet deal, as it were. Thank you. And you're also supporting everything that you hear on Milwaukee Public Radio and all the people who make what you hear possible. And you should include yourself in that because your contribution makes all of that possible.
Call 414-227-3210 or visit us at wuwm.com/give. Thank you so much for your tax-deductible contribution. Don't forget, you can become a sustaining member, make a contribution of maybe $5 a month, $10, or maybe you can afford $20 a month. Every amount is important to us, and it's just as important that you become among the ranks of members of Milwaukee Public Radio, WUWM. 414-227-3210.
Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next. Stay tuned.
It's my universe, even with an empty purse, 'cause I've got a pocket full of dreams.